This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Hello, this is Stuart Harper at the National Astronomy Meeting, and I've been joined by Dr. Jane Berkby. And
Hi.
She's from Linden Observatory, Netherlands. And she's going to tell us a little bit about her talk here, which was on hot Jupiters orbiting M-dwarfs. What's an M-dwarf, exactly?
Okay, good. So I should explain. So M-dwarfs are stars, but they are stars that are smaller than the Sun. They're about half the size of the Sun and about half the mass. And because they're much smaller, they're much cooler, about 3,000 Kelvin, so again, about half the temperature of the Sun, and they look red.
So are they formed that way, or are they late evolutionary-type stars?
Yeah, it's just a natural outcome of star formation. But there's a particular reason why we want to look at M-dwarfs for what I'm doing specifically. I study transits of exoplanets. And a transit is when an exoplanet passes in front of its host star, so the star that it's orbiting, mm-hmm. and that casts a shadow down on the Earth. And we measure that as a slight dimming of light. As we just watch the star over a function of time, we just see the light dip a little bit. And if you have something the size of the Sun and something the size of an M-dwarf, like half the size, and if you take, for example, Jupiter, when it passes in front of the smaller star, it will block more of the light, more of the disk of that star, than it will do of the Sun. And that will create a larger dimming of the light, and therefore they're much easier to detect. So that's why we target these little small stars, because we have much more chance of finding planets because of the bigger signals that they induce in these light curves. So you could even look for Earth-sized planets around M-dwarfs. But I guess what's the target of our survey, so it's called the WIFCAM Transit Survey, and we use the United Kingdom Infrared Telescope, which is located on Mauna Kea in Hawaii, up on the mountain, which I've been to, and it's lovely.
And the
reason we do this, we look in the infrared, because these M-dwarfs are, because they're cooler than the Sun, they emit more of their radiation in the infrared rather than at the optical wavelengths that we see the Sun in. And so we're more sensitive to the photons coming from the star, and so we can get much more precise light curves, so our errors on what we're doing are much smaller. And the reason we study M-dwarfs is because there are predictions from planet formation theory. There are two theories, and they're competing against each other. So one of them is called core accretion, mm-hmm. and the other one is called gravitational instability. Planets form in the disks that are around stars. Mm-hmm. That's common to both mechanisms that I'm going to talk about. So with core accretion, what we have is all the little bits of dust that are in the disk around the star as it's forming start to clump together. And as they clump together, they start gravitationally attracting all their other friends around them. And that builds up this little core of solid material. So that solid material also then starts to attract gas as well. And over time, if it builds up more gas, it turns into a hot, well, it turns into a Jupiter-like object. So it has this solid core and then some gas around it. And that can take a long time. It can take about 10 million years in order to accrete enough gas to form a Jupiter-like object. Whereas in the other mechanism, this gravitational instability, what you have is rather than these little cores building up first, which is the, what takes the long time, you actually just have parts of the disk just fragment. And the fragments of the disk collapse down in a similar way to the way stars form, just under their own gravity, this little clump of gas and dust gravitationally attracts itself so that the solid material sinks to the core and you're left with a gaseous outer envelope. And so the end result is still two Jupiter-like objects. They're formed in very different ways, but the timescale for the gravitational instability mechanism is much quicker. And so if we take this mechanism and translate it down to planets that form around small stars, because everything is much smaller, there's less angular momentum, everything happens more slowly. And the idea is that if it takes a long time in core accretion to build up the cores to make the hot Jupiters, the time that needs is longer than the time that the gas exists in the disk around the star before that gas is blown out by the host star as it forms. So you need that gas because that's what sits around your Jupiter-like planets. So if core accretion is right, then what we should see when we look at M-dwarfs is a lack of Jupiter-like planets. We shouldn't see them. We should only see tiny transits from small Earth-like and Neptune-like planets. But if gravitational instability is the mechanism that we want, then we should find lots of hot Jupiters. And so in order to get a really strong observational constraint, I mean, that's what, if you're going to really calibrate a theory, really understand your physics of what you're doing, you need strong observational constraints. And in order to do that, you need a huge sample of M-dwarfs. And they're really hard to find because they're small and they're cool, they're faint. And so you have to look a little bit longer to find an M-dwarf in the night sky. We have to look at large areas of the sky. And because we're looking for these transits, the probability of seeing something transit scales with the radius and the separation of the planet from the host star. So the smaller you go, the more stars you need to look at before you have a chance of seeing something pass directly in front of its star along your line of sight. There's much more probability that it will pass below the star or something, and you just won't see it. So the aim of our survey is to do one of the largest M-dwarf surveys to date from the ground to see if we find any hot Jupiters around these M-dwarfs. And so far, out of about 4,000 M-dwarfs that we've looked at, we haven't found any. And so, but this is a good thing for core accretion, though, because it then suggests that, okay, perhaps that is the right mechanism. So at the moment, our survey is still ongoing, and we hope to complete it within the next year, depending on how good the weather is in Wanaka. I should explain that we're actually a backup program for the United Kingdom Infrared Telescope, in that we can actually do our work in relatively poor conditions, because we're just looking for the relative change in light. And so if we manage to complete within the next year, we'll have this sample of about 10,000 M-dwarfs. And with that, we should be able to place a really strong constraint on which of these two theories is supported by the observational evidence. And then, so this, at the moment, we're about level with the Kepler constraints, if you know of the Kepler spacecraft. This is excellent space mission that's been returning all these exoplanet transits. So we hope that by the time we finish our survey, we'll be better than the current constraints from Kepler. And then we will be superseded by the Palomar Transient Factory M-dwarf survey, who will be looking at 100,000 M-dwarfs. And so the more numbers you have, the tighter and tighter the constraints. If you see nothing out of 10,000, and then if you see nothing out of 100,000, you know that the existence of these hot Jupiters around M-dwarfs is really rare. And that points towards
the core accretion method formation. So do you not see anything then in transits? Because if you don't see hot Jupiters, you would mention that there could be rocky planets.
Yeah,
but
so
do you not even see the rocky planets?
For us, so the problem is because we're a ground-based survey, we're limited to the precision with which we can detect the changes of light. Right. So changes caused by a Jupiter, we can detect, because it's quite a significant change, on the order of 3% to 10%, depending on the specific size of the star for these M-dwarfs. Whereas Earth-like planets, although for perhaps some of the few brightest targets in our survey, we would be able to see the tiny 1% change in flux from the star. The number of those in our survey is quite low. And so, like I said about the probability of something transiting, you need lots and lots of bright stars for us to be sensitive to those kind of objects. So the fact that we don't see Earth-like planets doesn't mean that they aren't there. In fact, we know they're there because Kepler has shown that small planets seem to be abundant around smaller stars. It's just the fact that our particular survey isn't sensitive to finding them. Right. But we definitely are sensitive to hot Jupiters, and because we don't find them, then we can say something about formation theory.
Right, okay. So what about specifically about your talk then?
My talk here was found in the WIFCAM Transit Survey, but it was more of a serendipitous discovery in that we don't just look at the M-dwarfs in our field. We look at all the stars, and stars can be G-dwarfs and K-dwarfs, and a K-dwarf is somewhere between the size of the Sun and an M-dwarf, so it's about three-quarters of the size of the Sun, about there. And what we found was a hot Jupiter, but it orbits its star in just one day, like whizzing around in one day. And the existence of these really close-in, really hot Jupiters, I mean, they're really close to the host star, so they're being highly irradiated. And what happens is that is it bloats the planet, it puffs it up bigger. So the object we found is about 30% fatter than Jupiter actually is, but it's only got the mass of Jupiter. And so there's something in it that's causing it to puff up, and this is another area of cutting-edge exoplanet research, is that why does this happen? It's not clear which specific mechanism would cause that to happen. For us, what's interesting about this object is that because it's so close, there's really not much time left, if you take current theory, before it hits the host star. So in terms of, if you think along cosmic timescales, based on current theory, we expect this planet to hit the star in 25 million years.
Cosmically, not that.
Yeah. And so what we think is that one of the parameters, the efficiency of this decay of the orbit, so the efficiency of how fast it moves in, the current parameters that describe that aren't quite right. And indeed, there is a growing evidence to show that there's something not quite right there. And it's to do with the actual internal structure of the star, we think. Stars of different mass are different inside. Some of them have regions where photons radiate out, and other regions they have convection layers. And depending on how much convection there is and how much radiation is, will change how fast the orbit of the planet falls into the host star.
Could that explain then why you're not seeing them in the smaller M dwarfs? I mean,
So Jupiters have to form further away from the star, where ices can condense. But then there's this theory of migration, and that these Jupiters do come in, so they fall much further out, like where Jupiter is around in our own solar system. But these hot Jupiters have come in much closer, and they're within the orbit of Mercury. That's how close they are. So how they get there, there's different theories on how giant planets actually move in. But at some point, there must be something that kind of stops that happening as well. And again, this is another unknown area of exoplanet research at the moment.
What exactly is it that tells you that it is falling in? How do you measure that if you're only doing a transit going once across?
So it transits its star every 1.01 days.
All right, so fairly fast.
Then. Yeah, and so the amount of time it takes to actually cross in front of the star is... I calculated this the other day. It's basically 1.5 hours.
Oh, right.
Almost exactly. So you see it transit for 1.5 hours and then it disappears for the rest of the day and then it comes back again.
Okay.
And what we do is we do repeat observations. Like I said, we've been observing for nearly 5 years now. And over time you build up your light curve. And what you do is you try all these different orbital periods and you take your data and you fold it around on itself. And if you get the correct orbital period, you see your flat line and you see this nice... sort of imagine an upside down top hat, and that's what we see in our data.
So thank you very much for speaking with us. And goodbye.
Thanks. Bye.